Blog Talk Radio. This episode of Kimberly's Intentional Moment is brought to you by the Seiken Network on Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and good morning. This is Kimberly Knaus, and this is Kim Talk Radio, or Kimberly's Intentional Moment. I am so excited today to introduce and welcome my teacher and my friend, Salvatore Zambito, to the show. I met Salvatore because I had to do a Yoga Sutras class for yoga teacher training, and because I preferred one-on-one rather than the classroom, and like many Westerners, I wanted some physical practice, I didn't want to just sit and listen. And so it was uncomfortable for me. What happened next surprised me, and it shifted my thinking forever. When a true teacher speaks, he or she is not just conveying information, but is transmitting or has a transmission of a deeper state of consciousness. The fact that he is silly, gregarious, and fun, and at the same time honest, even when it's hard for me or others to hear, you can create a life bond, or we have created a life bond, beyond what I ever thought possible, and I am so fortunate to be a part of it. Before we talk to Salvatore, I want to introduce his two reference works, two works of yoga, The Unadorned Thread of Yoga, and the Yoga Sutras, Sanskrit English Dictionary. And if you have any questions, and I will repeat this later at the end of the show, you can contact him at salvatore@yogasutras.net. So, having said that, Salvatore, when did you begin your yoga journey, and who were your main guides?
Thank you, Kimberly. It's always a pleasure to be with you. My first formal yoga class I attended in 1967 in Chicago at the Shivananda Yoga Center. And my teacher was a woman named Margaret Yeoman. But something that is a little bit different then than now was that if you were going to study yoga in the 60s, 70s, and earlier, you were going to be working directly with the Indian authorities or the first generation of their students. So the teacher I was working with was Swami Vishnu Devananda, and Margaret was his student. So I worked both with him and with her. When Swami would come to town, I would drive him around Chicago. I would be his asana model. As he was giving a lecture, I would perform the asanas that he was talking about. But the benefit for me was that driving him around, I got to have personal conversations with a man who, in time, became acknowledged as quite a yoga master. As the years have gone by, at this point in time, we're probably on the 7th or 8th generation of Western students of these Indian authorities. And frankly, there's been some loss and a narrowing down of the teachings through those years. When I was studying with the Shivananda, there were three things that we had to do for our yoga practice. The first was asana pranayama. The second was meditation. And the third was vegetarian diet. It was understood that asana pranayama was for the support of meditation. And we only learned and taught 12 asanas and 2 pranayama. And this led to meditation, which was understood that it was all preparatory for the meditative state.
Thanks, Salvatore. I just want to let the listeners know out there that we are having some technical difficulties, and so if it seems as though that intro was a little, we were skipping over it or fumbling over it, that was why. Thank you so much, Salvatore. So one of the things that I think a lot of our listeners would like to know, and I certainly would like to hear it again from you, is why are there so many translations of the Yoga Sutra into English, and how many are there?
I think it's a really good and valid question. What I'd like to do first for some of your listeners is tell you what the Yoga Sutras is. It's easy to jump to an assumption here. I think it's useful to remember that yoga had its origins in India, and it's a 5,000-year-old written tradition. India is a culture with 5,000 years of literacy, 2.5 times Western civilization in terms of age. One of the characteristics of India was that it was very non-material. This region, we now call India and Pakistan, used to be 1,500 little nations that now politically are two entities. So what we talk about India now is a very different situation from India 5,000 years ago. In fact, I'm going to tell you, and I'm digressing, but there's a reason for this. The very name India came from Alexander the Macedonian, sometimes called Alexander the Great. The Macedonian army swept from Greece, across Turkey, across the lands we now call Afghanistan, and got in Persia or Iran, and got into India, almost to the Ganges. When they got to a river called the Sindhu, the Greeks were unable to say the Sanskrit Shah. And so they took it off the front and put it on the back and made it into the Indus. From this Greek mispronunciation of the river Sindhu, we have India. Now, if you live in India long enough that Indians regard you as a local, they don't use the word India anymore. They use their name for India, which is Bharat. And this means the land of the learned. So anytime we're dealing with India, we're very wise to assume we know nothing and that most of what we think we know is wrong. So going back to your question about the Yoga Sutra, one of the characteristics of this region we call India, or Bharat, was a lack of interest in technology. This Bharat was one of the few areas in the world that never invented the wheel. The people of Bharat on one side took the wheel from Burma, and on the other side took the Persian wheel from the Persians. They didn't need to. However, there were some characteristics here that are utterly unique. For example, the concept of zero, the mathematical concept of zero, was Indian. This has absolutely created the possibility of mathematics as we know it. The number system that we use in the West is called the Arabic numerals. That's because the West got them from the Arab traders. But the Arab traders got them from India. When they traded with India, they found this numbering system, and this numbering system was perfect for bookkeeping. But then, let's remember, the Arabs took the zero and created something that we call algebra. But they called it algebra. So take the A-L, put a hyphen in it, and you've got algebra, which was an Arab contribution to the world based on the understanding of zero. The Indians also created chess. They created a musical system that had 60 scales, including one set of scales that's theoretical, and over 110 musical instruments. So they had a completely different approach to the physical world than the rest of the people. Now, this is where it comes to mean something for yoga. because of the focus that they had on the life of the mind, they developed a very broad system of philosophical inquiry. Every area of Western philosophy was investigated in India to the point of total exhaustion 1,000 years before Western civilization even emerged. Now, what happened in that time was that the many schools of philosophy, like we have in the West, became distilled to the point that they had one school of six schools. This is called the Shad Darshana. Shad means six. Darshana means viewpoints. So their six schools of orthodox philosophy were more correctly called, what we call philosophy, the six viewpoints. One of those six viewpoints was yoga. Now, yoga had a few functions here, and I'm not going to give you all of them, but one of them was that it roughly held the position of psychology in the Western world. But their understanding of psychology included the sense of an internal self, which is very different from most of the West. So what we had called transpersonal psychology was kind of a foundation of their understanding. And from this came a school of philosophy known as the Yoga Darshana. There are many schools within this. Now, each of the darshana, each of the viewpoints, had a great sage who organized and created a central textbook. The Yoga Darshana had a textbook called the Yoga Sutra, written by the great sage Patanjali. A sutra. Sutra means thread, and the English word suture comes from sutra. So the idea of a book called a sutra is that we take areas of knowledge and distill it. So a single short statement will be a sutra. But if we take an entire book of them, then the book itself is called a sutra. The Yoga Sutra of Patanjali has 196 short statements. All of them together are supposed to, and I think it does this, creates a distillation of the field under study. So when it's in the title of a book, the word sutra means a single thread unadorned by a single bead. It tells us that no word can be taken away and no more word is needed. It has been brought to its purest distillation. Now, all sutras, all the books for all of the darshana are written in a language of Sanskrit. The Yoga Sutra, so far as I can tell, has been translated into English at least 103 times. And the reason for this is that certain key concepts in yoga simply don't exist in English. Therefore, there's no vocabulary for it. Also, the sutra system has a unique grammatical structure, which we don't have. The entire Yoga Sutra, 196 statements, has four verbs and 28 participles. So all of the rest of them are written like mathematical formula that do not involve tense and they don't involve person. And there's really no English form that goes outside of tense and goes outside of person. If we bear this in mind, perhaps we can bridge to a world that saw reality in a very different way.
Thank you so much, Salvador. I was going to ask you whether we call this the Yoga Sutras or the Yoga Sutra.
Both are correct. I tend to use, when I'm speaking of the book, I tend to talk of the Yoga Sutra, but it's composed of Yoga Sutras. No need to overthink this.
Thank you so much, because we do that a lot.
Something that you have talked to me or I've heard you say more than once is that, or to go fast, or something that you recommend is for us to go fast by going slow. Can you explain that?
Oh, yes. This is one of my obsessions. We want fast food. We want fast effects. One of our American conditionings, which is almost a pathology, is a desire for instantaneous mastery. And the story of the tortoise and the hare is not a joke. This is a really powerful and important parable. And so if you come to a place of of studying the Indian tradition, the ancient masters might have disciples that they would give one or two breathing exercises and one or two movements that would be a lifetime of practice. When I was teaching yoga and stress management at Boise State University, in one semester, I had a couple of really interesting students. One of them was a little milkmaid from Bliss, Idaho, who was, this would be 1981 or 1982. And she was a ballerina, had incredible flexibility. And next to her on the mat in the wrestling room was a wrestler. And wrestlers have a lot of flexibility too, but not as much as this girl did. And I think this young man had a little bit of a crush on the milkmaid. And he was pushing himself a little bit, which is not what I recommend, but young people are in a hurry. And so he did a head-knee pose one day and was trying to bring his nose to his knees like she could, and in the process tore a hamstring.
Ow.
He was a very strong and determined young man. It's not actually easy to do that. So I actually had a certain amount of admiration for that. But the net effect was that it took him much longer to eventually do a deeper head-knee pose because he had to add recovery time to ordinary growth. So I recommend in all areas, physical, emotional, relationship, mental, go fast by going slow. Give yourself time to learn and to integrate and to apply.
Thank you. You know, one of the things that I tell my students often is it's better for us to take the time that we need in order to stay present in a posture or in asana, and I want to get to that in a minute with you, rather than being set back by being injured and now we're laying on the couch and we're recovering, and just like you said with the wrestler. And I would like to talk to you a little bit about that. So what is the difference between Hatha yoga and Raja yoga? Or actually, I think some of my listeners would like to know, what's the difference between Hatha yoga and asana?
Well, if you go back to some of the earlier points I was making, there are many schools of yoga. And the one that is best known in the West is Hatha yoga. And I might point out right here the pronunciation. It's not Hatha yoga, it's Hatha yoga. There is no th sound in Sanskrit. And if it's properly written, it would be H-A under dotted T, H-A, which would give you the reference to the correct Sanskrit letter and pronunciation. So it's Hatha yoga. And Hatha yoga is composed of three main areas, asana, pranayama, the mulas and the bandhas, and the kriyas. So actually it's more than three. The word asana comes originally from the root as, which means to sit. So the difference, the core difference between Hatha Yoga and Raja Yoga is that the core of Raja Yoga is meditation, while the core of Hatha Yoga, they can have a couple of goals, but one of the main goals is asana, to prepare the body for sitting. Now, this comes from the word as. This is a long A, the A with a long mark over it, A, S, as. It means in Sanskrit, it's the verb root to sit or to apply oneself. So the asana in the Yoga Sutra, which is the handbook of Raja Yoga, is speaking to the sitting practices. In Hatha Yoga, the asanas, sometimes called postures or poses, this is not linguistically quite as precise. But if you read the first two verses of the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, which is the handbook of Hatha Yoga, the first two verses make it clear that the Hatha Yoga Pradipika and Hatha Yoga are preparatory for Raja Yoga, which is to say preparatory for the sitting practices. So we have to get our joints loose so that we can sit, but we also have to have the spine, the hips, the head, everything has to be aligned so that we can sit comfortably for 20 minutes. The respiratory capsule has to be balanced and expanded so that we can sit. You can't sit in a straight posture if your breath is constrained. And the mind cannot be brought to a single point if the breathing is random. So the entirety of Hatha Yoga can be seen in one of its branches as preparing the body for sitting practices, and in this way, the two work together. So they aren't really, they're distinct from each other, they contribute to each other. I don't like to think of them as separate. The problem here is, in the Western world, is that the term asana has come to be synonymous with yoga. In the year 2000, I wanted to reconnect with a Swami I hadn't seen for 18 years, and I found that he was giving a talk, and I attended that talk, and it was in a beautiful lecture hall, and he was up on a stage, and when the talk was done, I joined his disciples in a line at the stairs so that we could give him the Anjali Mudra, which is the hands together, the hands in prayer called Anjali Mudra. And I was about the fifth or sixth in line. As he came down the steps, he saw me, made eye contact, walked past the five or six people, came to me, put his hands on either side of me. And remember, I hadn't seen him for 18 years, Kimberly. And what he said was, I have a job for you if you want to do it. No, hi, how are you? No small talk. You know, I've got work for you. And I said, I'll do it if I can, Swamiji. He said, an urgent situation is emerging in the Western world. The terms yoga and asana are becoming synonymous. As you know very well, asana is part of yoga, but yoga is much more than asana. I am deputizing you in your teaching to specifically uncouple the manner in which these have become synonymous and bring people to an understanding of the larger field. He said the Himalayan Swamis would not have believed even 10 years ago that it was possible for the definition of yoga to become distorted in the collective consciousness. Now we see that the power of the Western media is such that such a confusion is actually possible, even imminent. So I'm asking you to do your part and deputize others. And so I'm deputizing you, as I've done before, Kimberly.
I take that very seriously.
Thank you. To bring a clarification to this, asana is important in the Hatha Yoga tradition, but it's not yoga itself, and it ultimately leads to asana in the Raja Yoga tradition.
Oh, thank you so much for that. Listen,
we are going to take just a quick break and allow you to sit with, you the listeners and myself, to sit with what we have just learned. Thank you so much, Salvatore. And we're going to take a quick break and listen to an ad for the, well, it's not an ad, it's an upcoming symposium coming up for Tai Chi. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Restita De Jesus.
And I'm Robert Deal.
We're the founders of the Seika Network on blogtalkradio.com.
And we've got some great events that we'd like to share with you.
On July 6th through the 11th, 2014, the International Tai Chi Chuan Symposium will present an exciting event where five Tai Chi Grandmasters, each representing the traditional Chen, Yang, Wu Hao, Wu, and Sun styles of Tai Chi, will share their knowledge and skills. Tai Chi practitioners from all levels, including beginners, will benefit from this opportunity to learn and practice directly with the Grandmasters. The five masters that will be teaching at this event are Chen Zhenlei, Yang Jun, Zhang Zhenchan, Ma Hailong, and Sun Yongtian. You don't even have to be an experienced Tai Chi practitioner to attend. Whether you're a health promotion planner, healthcare provider, personal trainer, martial artist, physical education instructor, or school administrator, all are welcome to attend. Don't miss this opportunity to train directly under the masters. For more information to register for Directly from the Source, just go to www.taichisymposium.com or you can email info@taichisymposium.com.
That sounds like a good time. You had said maybe you'd be interested in going to that Tai Chi symposium. Yeah? Wouldn't I? Yeah. Okay. So, Salvatore, when we left, we were talking about Hatha Yoga, asana. We talked about how in the West it's being confused, or that yoga and asana are being confused as synonymous, and they are not. Asana being a part of yoga, yoga being something much larger, a much larger field, something that you said. How I had understood it, and many of my students coming to yoga understood the word yoga, is that it meant union. Can you elaborate on that? Is that in fact true?
Yes, it's true. But like so many other elements with yoga, it's part of a larger truth. And something that's hard to learn if you don't spend time with the old Indian teachers who are immersed in the ancient tradition and who really know Sanskrit. Now, I have some knowledge of Sanskrit, but I don't want to make too big of a deal about that. It's useful, and it's been good enough to write a dictionary with some skilled help. But this is where a lot of understanding can be found. So what I would start with some misunderstandings about the word asana before I go into yoga is it comes to mind that there's another confusion relative to asana, which has to do with fitness. Yoga asana does not have a fitness concern. Yoga asana is designed to bring the body to sitting posture comfortably with the breath organized so that it can help bring the mind to a single point, which perhaps we can talk about a little bit later, either today or in another interview. The confusion here, when yoga asana is used as physical fitness, is that the correct word for that in Sanskrit would be vyayama. Vyayama. V-Y-long-A-Y-long-A-M-A. Vyayama. This is exercise. And there's nothing wrong with exercise, and there's nothing wrong with fitness. It's beautiful. You need it. It's just not yoga.
Yes. Okay.
Okay? So going back to your question about yoga itself, it's useful to understand that the culture from which Sanskrit emerged saw the world and existence, reality, in a very different way from the Western world. I have to, because we can't really understand yoga unless we can understand the world from which it came, because yoga was based on a different set of assumptions than we have in the Western world. The continuity of matter and energy was understood in the Vedic civilization. It's only 100 years old in the West. E equals mc squared is a very young understanding in the Western world. And look at the transformations that have come in the last 80 or 100 years from Einstein. Imagine where we will be in 5,000 years when we have been working with this concept. Let me just explain it as I understand it. E equals mc squared tells us that energy is matter vibrating at the rate of the speed of light squared. But the inverse of that tells us that matter is energy stepped down, divided by, stepped down by the speed of light squared. So a mystic in the late 19th century, Madame Blavatsky, said, energy and matter are the same thing along a spectrum of vibration. Now, the scientists of her time mocked her, but now it's a central understanding of Western physics. This understanding of energy-matter continuum was part of the Vedic civilization and incorporated into the Sanskrit language.
So you're saying that they understood this already?
They did.
They already knew.
Somehow they did. And I read a sutra in high school, and I believe it was the Shiva Sutra, but I wouldn't swear to that. But I did write down this particular sutra. This goes back to 1965, so give me a break. But the sutra said, all manifested reality is the outcome of the interplay of various permutations of vibrations of light. All manifested reality, all physical reality, all energetic reality is the outcome of the interplay of various permutations, various forms of vibrations of light. So this is a very nice way of saying E equals MC squared. And this is a 5,000-year-old text. Now, this becomes important for yoga because yoga has an underlying hypothesis that there is a latent form of consciousness within each of us, that we are functioning as separate beings who think that we, that I think I'm over here and I think you're over there.
Yeah.
This is the day-to-day assumption. But the yogic hypothesis is that underneath this, that or vibrating through this, the higher form of consciousness, the higher vibration that we can get in touch with, and the transformation becomes possible through conscious manipulation of energy and transformation. In Sanskrit, all nouns come from root verbs. So the understanding that all physical things are in a constant state of vibration, movement, and change is inherent and encoded in the language.
The Western,
unlike ours, when we have noun, rigid noun-verb separations, rigid subjects and predicates, in effect, what English is trying to do is freeze reality at every given point in time, and it doesn't work very well because everything is changing constantly. Nothing holds still for even a moment. And so if you've had even sixth grade level physics, you know this to be true, but your language does not encode this reality that we know to be true. Sanskrit does.
Yeah.
Sanskrit, particularly in some of its forms, allows you to go completely beyond noun-verb separations and completely beyond subject-predicate stuff. One of my main teachers, Swami Veda Bharati, makes a contention that Sanskrit has, in effect, and this is a, I quote, a quantum part of speech, so to speak, unquote. So this is where the Yoga Sutra, another area where it becomes so hard to translate, because most of the, there are only four verbs, and I mentioned it before, 28 participles for time reference. The rest of them are like linguistic mathematical formulas that relate to how consciousness can transform. Now we go to yoga.
Okay.
I'm sorry I've had to circle around, but your question sounded simple, but it isn't.
No, it isn't.
The Sanskrit language has the first complete grammar in recorded history. It's called the Astadhyayi by the great grammarian Panini. It means a work in eight chapters. A part of this, incorporated from a previous time, is a work called the Dhatupada, or the recitation of verbs. And this lists all the verb roots in Sanskrit. That's amazing.
Yeah.
From which all nouns come.
Okay.
So the root for yoga is huge, and it appears three times in the four sections of the Dhatupada. In the first one, it means control. In the second iteration, it means to join or union. And the third one, it means samadhi. So this is a state of consciousness that we'll have to talk about as a separate issue. Now, in the Yoga Sutra, we have each of these short statements, but it's followed by a lengthy commentary by a man called Vyasa, but I frankly think it may have been Patanjali himself operating under another name. Yeah, it's very possible. They do things like that. Yeah, they're very tricky guys. So the first of the Yoga Sutras says, Atta Yogana Shasanam, and the literal translation would be now yoga within tradition. The paraphrasing, where we do it with standard English, but it's a mistranslation, would be now begins yoga instruction in tradition. Well, we have another situation where these words have cultural meanings enfolded into them that you know if you speak the language fluently. Now, this I don't do, but I've been given by good authority by someone who grew up speaking Sanskrit, and that would be Swami Veda, that a closer cultural translation for this first one would be, now, at this auspicious moment of transition from previous involvements, commences the transmission of yoga by those who are qualified to those who are prepared in the ancient tradition.
That's pretty loaded.
It's pretty loaded. But then if we go into the commentary, the second sentence of the commentary explains something very important. It says, samadhiha yogaha. Now the Y-O-G-A with an underdotted H, yogaha, samadhiha, also ends with the underdotted H. This is a grammatic structure called a visarga. And when two words in a Sanskrit sentence have a visarga, it creates the grammatical equivalent of an equal sign. Therefore, when Swamiji, when Patanjali says yogaha samadhiha, he's saying yoga equals samadhi. Samadhi is that state of consciousness where the person becomes completely integrated. Now, this is where the, let's hold off on that a second.
Okay.
Then we'll deal with the word union.
Yes.
The this is telling us that from that point on, the root involved, whenever you see the word yoga, again in the Yoga Sutra, is revolving around the root, huge, that refers to samadhi.
Not
union. Now, some authorities, including Swami Veda, contend that the word yoga, when it's used in the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the Yoga Vaishishta, the various great texts, the Yoga Sutra, that the reference is to the samadhi root.
Okay.
However, it's also speculated that the ancient sages who worked with these concepts and practices all of their lives in forests and mountains, and this was all they did, experienced the dissolving of ego restrictions as a union with a potential self. So when we go into talking about samadhi, here becomes the difficulty. Our models of psychology are not elaborate enough or complete enough to immediately go straight across. We do not have a word for this. When I was studying Greek, we had a similar problem. There was the word enstasy. Enstasy and samadhi mean the same thing. When the biblical scholars tried to translate it, they came up with the peace that passeth all understanding, because there is no English word for enstasy. In 1986, when the great yoga scholar Georg Forstein did his another translation, he did several of the Yoga Sutras, he translated samadhi as enstasy. I wrote him a note and said, gee, Georg, you know, translating Sanskrit into Greek for English speakers may be a bit of a lateral shift. I don't know if this is very helpful. And he wrote a very droll note back acknowledging it, and we had a conversation about the difficulty of moving these in, because the concept of a peace that passeth all understanding exists in India, exists in Persia, existed in Palestine. The Aramaic had a word for it, the Greeks had a word for it, but not enough people in the English-speaking world have experienced this for us to have a word for it.
Whoa.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay, so we experience ourselves as very independent moving meatballs who have various forms of psychological disabilities that we call ego. What the Yoga Sutra and what the yoga world lays out is that there is a potential consciousness that has a peace that passeth all understanding that occurs when these ego separations dissolve. So this is where the issues of union and control come in with the root huge. The issues of control are issues of bringing in the practices, which include seeing ourselves with ruthless compassion. And then, as the ego restrictions dissolve, we experience ourselves gradually coming into this place. The ego disappears. Honey, there's nothing left. People say, wouldn't enlightenment be nice? Maybe, but you won't know, because you'll be gone.
Wow.
You'll be gone. And So what I'm saying here is that the word union may have come in from usage of describing that gradual process by which the separated self moves into the integrated, undifferentiated self. And a great deal here of when we say we're all one, that's not a mystical abstraction. That's now physics. E equals mc squared. If E equals mc squared, then we're all one. We're all part of, ultimately, an unbroken energy field.
You know, I would like to go back for just a second to the control piece. One more time, explain huge as control, because we do not know control to be what you're talking about. When we think of control, we think I'm controlling a situation, or I fear that I can't control a situation. So once again, explain what you meant or what Huge meant by control.
That's a really good point. And I really have to work on some synonyms that might be more applicable here.
Yeah.
I hesitate to insert myself into redefining the Dhatupada.
That's fair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, that's a level of authority I don't take, but I think it probably, you brought up something that really needs to be considered. Because what we mean by control here is gentle containment and direction. So if I want to get better control, say, of my hips, and I move into a head-knee pose, I am bringing a certain set of control to muscles in the legs, the buttocks, the low back. But the goal here is not to give them a Nazi-style level of control, but to bring a gentle level of direction and containment to them so they'll actually be more comfortable.
Yes, so we go back to going, what you say is go fast by going slow.
Go fast by going slow. The whole, everything in yoga is about gentleness. When I hear somebody talking about no pain, no gain in yoga, they're not talking about yoga.
Right.
They're talking about, they're not even talking about Vyayama in the Indian sense of it, because there's a level of violence here that is not yoga.
Yeah.
Now, I would point out that going back to the issues of Hatha yoga and Hatha yoga asana, that in the Shivananda system, the lord of the asanas was Shavasana, the corpse pose.
Many of my students love this pose.
Well, I'll tell you, that's great. And that speaks to you as a teacher, because in my experience in the Western world now, if an asana is going to get dropped out of a sequence, it will usually be Shavasana. And Shavasana is what it's all about. Bringing the body to complete relaxation is the intent of Hatha Yoga Asana Yoga, or Yoga Asana. So the goal here in Hatha Yoga Asana is not to become strong and well-balanced and a wonderful mating prospect. The idea...
or to have what I've seen in some videos, a yoga butt.
No.
We don't need that.
Well,
yes, we do, but
well,
not like that.
Not like that, yeah. Because understand the yoga butt. In the ancient tradition, Anushasanam,
yes,
is a butt that can sit quietly and comfortably on a seat for 20 minutes.
That's right. That's very different than a firm butt.
Very much so. And there's nothing wrong with either one. It's just the confusion.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much, Salvatore. I am going to take a quick break here for a PSA, and we will be right back.
Did you hear he tried out for the school's basketball team? He'd make a better ball than a player.
Yeah, he's so fat, the only exercise he gets is running after the ice cream truck.
Did you see the new girl in English today? She's so ugly, she could make onions cry.
She must like to conserve energy. She clearly gets dressed in the dark every morning.
Not funny? Well, neither is cyberbullying. What you may think is just a harmless joke could really hurt someone's feelings. Think about what you put on the internet. It's no laughing matter.
How true. It is so sad that we have something now called cyberbullying, bullying in general. And coming right off of that PSA, something that I talked about in the last show, and I want to continue as a thread through the Kimberly's Intentional Moment show, and definitely want to talk to you about, Salvatore, is feedback and constructive feedback and the truth. Hearing the truth, and our reactions to that. And I'd like to ask you, when a person attacks your credibility, whether it's professionally or personally, what is your personal response?
Mostly I say thank you. And if we're honest with ourselves, we don't know everything. We can be in error. And I make no claim to perfection. And happily, I grew up in a family where I was not punished for being wrong. If I made a mistake and I acknowledged it, I mean, I was rewarded for acknowledging it. I don't think it's always that way. I don't think it's safe in America to be wrong. It may be more now than it used to be. So I think it was Hume who said the things that we find irritating in others give us a wonderful insight into ourselves.
Isn't that the truth?
Yes. And as I recall, and I'm paraphrasing Swami Veda, I believe he said something to the effect that your enemy will help you see something that you would avoid seeing in yourself. You know, and therefore, in many ways, your enemy is your best friend. Now, part of the difficulty here is cultural. We don't have in the Anglo-American world, a tradition of graceful disagreement. Now, I had the blessing to grow up in a Jewish neighborhood, and my best friend, Jeffries, his father was a rabbi, and I loved his dad. And when I was in the first grade, I asked him if he would be my Rebbe, and he had tears going down his cheek when he said, "Oh, Salvatore, it would be an honor, but you have to ask your dad." So I ran home and asked my dad. He said, "You want a Rebbe? I mean, you want a rabbi?" And I said, "Yes, Dad." And he said, "Why?" I said, "Oh, he's so wise, and he's so old." And I think he was about 36. But he and I stayed closer all the rest of my life, more than his son and I did. But when I was a little boy, he would take me to the debates that rabbis would have among themselves, and they could argue passionately, but they never lost their love and respect for each other. Because one of the Jewish parables or proverbs that I got from Rebbe Daniel was, disagreement is the gateway or a gateway to greater knowledge. And I remember now, I'll remember all my life, a vigorous debate between an old rabbi and a young rabbi. And it went on for quite a while. And at a certain point, the old rabbi said, "Let me see if I can summarize our argument." And he summarized his point, and he asked the young rabbi, he summarized the young rabbi's point and asked if he agreed. And the young rabbi said that he agreed with the summary. And the old man then totally demolished the young rabbi's argument, completely blew it away.
Wow.
The young rabbi was just stunned. I don't remember the arguments in 60 years, but I remember the structure of the communication. And then the young rabbi got up, walked across the room, and embraced the elder rabbi, kissed him on both cheeks, and said, "Thank you. You are my teacher." So now, Kimberly, when somebody attacks me either gracefully or from their own place of insecurity, I say thank you. Because even if they have no idea what they're talking about, they've given me an opportunity to interact in a delicate situation. If they do know what they're talking about, then they're my teacher. What's to be scared of?
Yeah, and you consider the source. Who are you asking for this truth?
Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Properly lived, every moment, every object, every person, every creature is a teacher.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. This has been such a treat having you on my show. Such a treat. I want to ask, is there anything that you would like to say as we wrap up the show today?
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. Remember, we want to, as a collective, be talking about these things. Feel free to contact me at kimtalkradio@gmail.com. You can also contact Salvatore himself at salvatore@yogasutras.net. So again, that's kimtalkradio@gmail.com or salvatore@yogasutras.net. With any questions or discussion you would like to have with us, Salvatore will be joining us from here on out once a month, maybe more if he will grace us with his presence. We have a very good time together. I want to also apologize for our technical difficulties. We will try to have that taken care of by the next time, but, you know, such is life. Remember to treat each other with dignity, respect, and mostly love, and be happy, practice peace always. Thank you again, Salvatore, for being with us. Really appreciate it. So much fun to have him on the show, and he is quite a sport, so feel free to ask him any questions whatsoever. Have a great day.
Because I'm happy. Come along if you feel like.